A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's what Daniel wrote to us. I'd like to chat about the human capacity for empathy. We've talked in various episodes about personality disorders, where a lack of empathy is pronounced or pathologically absent. As somebody who's known people with personality disorders, I'm painfully familiar with what it's like to have a relationship with people like this. It's ground we've covered before. But today, when I was thinking about the lack of empathy, I thought about, well, what's it? Because sometimes it's the absence of something that makes us wonder what this thing is. At the risk of sounding cliché, perhaps like love, empathy is the quiet currency that keeps what's good about humanity going. But unlike love, empathy hasn't been the subject of endless movies and works of literature. But maybe it's no less important. When we think about what it involves to be empathetic, it makes us understand why empathy is a unique capacity. It demands that we transcend our own inner lives. Which is why, I think, one of the great cruelties of the human condition, those who are struggling the most sometimes seem extremely selfish. If you're drowning in your own inner torment, you can't see beyond your own struggles. Let's look at what empathy is, why it's both essential but often missing where it's needed the most, and what we can do to train ourselves to be more mindful and considerate of those around us.
That's a substantial prompt. And the phrase that lands hardest for me is drowning in your own inner torment. Because I've seen that clinically. Someone in the depths of a major depressive episode, they're not choosing to be selfish. Their nervous system is maxed out, just keeping them alive.
So let's do what the prompt asks. Define it, understand why it breaks when we need it most, and figure out if we can actually get better at it. And let's start with a definitional mess. Because the research shows that empathy isn't one thing at all.
It really isn't. There was a scoping review published by Vieten and colleagues in 2018 that looked at 306 different measures of empathy. 306, and they found no consensus definition. The field is fragmented. Different measures are tapping entirely different constructs. Cognitive empathy, emotional empathy, empathic concern, personal distress. You can take two, empathy. Questionnaires, and they're measuring different things.
306 ways to measure something we can't agree on defining. That's almost poetic.
It's a mess. But it's also instructive. Because it tells you that when someone says, I'm not an empathetic person, or she lacks empathy, they're collapsing at least three separate neural systems into one word. And those systems can vary independently. You can be high in one and absent in another.
Which three?
Emotional sharing, empathic concern, and perspective taking. Emotional sharing is the most primitive one. It's basically mirroring. You see someone in distress, your own brain activates distress circuits. You flinch when someone else gets hit. Babies do this. It's automatic, it's fast, and it's not under conscious control. Empathic concern is different. It's the motivation to care for someone, the warmth, the desire to help. And perspective taking is the cognitive piece, understanding what someone else is thinking or feeling without necessarily feeling it yourself.
So the psychopath who knows exactly what you're feeling and uses it to manipulate you.
Intact perspective taking, deficient emotional sharing, and empathic concern. That's the dark empathy phenomenon. There was a study by Sun and colleagues in 2024 looking at empathy, compassion, and the dark triad, psychopathy, narcissism, Machiavellianism. They found individuals high in psychopathy and narcissism show deficits in emotional empathy, but can have perfectly intact cognitive empathy. They understand what you feel. They just don't care.
Which is somehow worse than if they were simply oblivious.
It is, because it means the cruelty is precise. They know exactly where to aim.
Daniel's analogy in the prompt was to love. Empathy is quiet currency. And I think the analogy is useful, but it has a limit. Love can be felt alone. You can feel longing, devotion, affection for someone who isn't present, even someone who's gone. Empathy requires an object in a different way. It's inherently relational. It demands, as he put it, that we transcend our own inner lives.
That's the key distinction. Empathy is the psychological infrastructure that allows us to coordinate, to care for each other, to build cooperative societies. It's not a luxury or a nice to have. Evolution selected for it because groups that could coordinate emotional states and respond to each other's needs outcompeted groups that couldn't. It's functional.
Which makes the suffering paradox, his phrase, drowning in your own inner torment, all the more cruel. If empathy is functional, why does it vanish precisely when people need it most?
To understand that, we need to look at the actual machinery. The three systems I mentioned don't just coexist peacefully. They compete for the same cognitive and emotional bandwidth, and personal distress. That's the fourth thing that shows up in a lot of empathy measures, and it's actually a confound. Personal distress is what happens when emotional sharing tips over into overwhelm. You see someone suffering, you feel their pain so acutely that your own nervous system goes into threat mode, and instead of moving toward them with empathic concern, you withdraw.
So the person who's suffering the most, their own personal distress is so loud, they can't hear anyone else's.
And this is where the Vieten Review is so important. They pointed out that many empathy measures conflate empathy with personal distress. Someone can score high on an empathy scale because they're reporting high personal distress. I feel upset when I see someone in pain. But that distress leads to withdrawal, not helping. It's the opposite of empathic concern.
Wait. So some of the people we've been calling highly empathetic because they're easily distressed by others' pain, those might actually be the people least able to help?
That's the finding. High personal distress predicts avoidance of suffering, not approach. If you're so flooded by someone else's pain that you can't regulate your own response, you'll cross the street to avoid the person in need. Not because you don't care, because you care too much to function.
That reframes the entire bystander effect.
It does. The classic interpretation of the bystander effect is apathy. Someone else will handle it. But a lot of the evidence points to personal distress. People freeze because they're overwhelmed by what they're witnessing. Their emotional sharing system activates so strongly that it triggers a self-protective shutdown. They're not indifferent. They're flooded.
I've seen this in clinical settings, I imagine.
All the time. Someone with major depression. Their own emotional pain consumes their attentional and affective bandwidth. They can't access empathic concern for others, not because they're selfish, but because their brain is in survival mode. The same neural resources that would normally be available for perspective taking and caring are fully occupied with keeping them alive. It's doing all the work. What looks like selfishness from the outside is often personal distress from the inside. And the tragedy is that the behavior pushes people away, which increases the isolation, which deepens the suffering, which consumes even more bandwidth. It's a vicious cycle.
And that brings us to the knock-on effect. The people who most need empathy, those in crisis, those with personality disorders, those in chronic pain, are often the hardest to empathize with.
Because their behavior triggers personal distress in us. Someone lashes out, someone withdraws, someone makes self-destructive choices. Watching, that's painful. And if we don't have the capacity to regulate our own distress response, our empathic concern shuts down. We pull away. The suffering person gets more isolated. The cycle tightens.
So the very people who need connection the most become the hardest to connect with. That's the paradox fully spelled out.
It's one of the genuine cruelties of the human condition. Evolution gave us this remarkable capacity for mutual care and then built it on hardware that shorts out under load.
So what do we do about it? Daniel's third question. Can we train ourselves to be more mindful and considerate?
The good news is that the research doesn't just describe the problem. There's a growing body of evidence that empathy is trainable. But, and this is the counterintuitive part, it's not trainable by simply trying harder to care.
Try harder to care? Sounds like a recipe for burnout anyway.
It is. What the evidence points to is something different. Effective empathy training targets specific components, and it starts with reducing personal distress. Before you can be present for someone else's suffering, you need to be able to hold your own nervous system steady.
So self-regulation is the prerequisite for other-oriented empathy.
That's the core insight. And it's why mindfulness training keeps showing up in the empathy intervention literature. Mindfulness builds the capacity to witness distress, your own or someone else's, without being consumed by it. You learn to notice the feeling, name it, let it be there, and still function.
There's a study you mentioned. Medical students?
Troutman and colleagues, 2025. They took medical students, a population that's notoriously at risk for empathy, declined during training, and put them through 8 weeks of structured empathy training. Mindfulness-based stress reduction, plus explicit perspective, taking exercises, plus loving-kindness meditation. At the end, they measured a 22% increase in empathic concern and a 15% decrease in personal distress on the Interpersonal Reactivity Index.
Those are real numbers. Modest, but consistent.
Modest and consistent is exactly what you want to see in this kind of research. It means the effect is real and replicable, not a fluke. And the key is that they weren't just telling students, care more. They were training the underlying skills, regulate your own distress, practice seeing the world from someone else's perspective, and cultivate the specific motivation to care.
Walk me through the components. If someone listening wanted to build this capacity, what's the sequence?
Step 1 is personal distress reduction. Mindfulness, grounding techniques, deep breathing, anything that builds your ability to stay present with discomfort without fleeing. The simplest version, when you notice yourself getting overwhelmed by someone else's suffering, pause and take 3 slow breaths. That's not avoidance, that's regulation. You're buying yourself the capacity to re-engage.
3 breaths. That's almost absurdly simple.
The mechanism isn't the breaths. The mechanism is interrupting the automatic threat response that says, this is too much, get away. 3 breaths tells your nervous system, I'm not in danger, I can stay.
And step 2?
Perspective taking exercises. This can be as simple as explicitly imagining someone's context before judging their behavior. The person who cut you off in traffic, maybe they're rushing to a hospital. The colleague who snapped at you, maybe they're going through a divorce, you don't have to be right. The exercise is the act of generating alternative explanations. It builds the cognitive muscle of seeing beyond your own immediate interpretation.
I've actually found this one useful. Cognitive empathy. Understanding how someone else thinks. It's trainable, and it reduces friction in ways that emotional appeals don't.
And step 3 is building empathic concern directly through practices like loving-kindness meditation. 5 minutes a day. You sit quietly and systematically generate wishes for the well-being of others, starting with someone you love, then someone neutral, then someone difficult, then all beings. It sounds woo-woo, but the neuroimaging data shows it changes activation patterns in the anterior insula and anterior cingulate, regions involved in empathy and emotion regulation.
5 minutes a day, 3 breaths when you're overwhelmed, imagining alternative explanations for people's behavior. This is all surprisingly concrete.
The research is surprisingly concrete, and none of it is try harder to care. It's all about building the infrastructure that makes caring sustainable.
That reframes the whole question. Daniel asked how to be more mindful and considerate, and the answer turns out to be, first, learn to manage your own distress, which is the opposite of what most people assume.
Most people assume empathy means setting yourself aside and focusing entirely on the other person. But if you set yourself aside without first stabilizing yourself, you just drown alongside them. The most compassionate thing you can do for someone in crisis is sometimes to hold your own distress steady so you can actually be present.
That's a line worth sitting with. The most compassionate thing you can do is hold yourself steady.
It changes how you think about boundaries, too. Setting a boundary isn't a failure of empathy. It's often what makes empathy possible. If you're so enmeshed in someone's suffering that you can't function, you're not helping them. You're just adding your own dysregulation to theirs.
What about the limits of this? If empathy is trainable, how far can we push it? Can we train ourselves to empathize with people who have harmed us?
I don't know that the research has a clean answer to that, and I'm not sure it should. There's a healthy boundary where empathy becomes self-destructive. Empathizing with someone who's actively harming you, that's not a skill deficit, that's a survival question. The same mindfulness that lets you stay present with someone's suffering also lets you recognize when staying present is causing harm to yourself.
So the training cuts both ways. It gives you the capacity to stay and the clarity to know when to leave.
That's the mature version of empathy, not just feeling what others feel, but having the discernment to know what to do with that feeling.
Daniel mentioned personality disorders at the start. people where the lack of empathy is pathologically absent. The Sun study on the Dark Triad suggests some of those deficits are structural. Can training help there?
That's an open question. The Dark Triad findings suggest that people high in psychopathy can understand what you feel. Their cognitive empathy is intact, but they don't share the feeling and they don't care. Training might improve the cognitive piece, but the emotional piece? We don't know if that's trainable in those populations. The deficit seems to be in the basic capacity for emotional sharing, not in the skill of deploying it.
So for some people, the hardware just isn't there.
For some people, the hardware isn't there. And that's a hard truth. But for the vast majority of people, the ones whose empathy isn't pathologically absent, just overwhelmed or underdeveloped, the evidence says it's trainable.
Let me pull this back to Daniel's original framing. He said empathy is the quiet currency that keeps what's good about humanity going. And I think what the research adds to that metaphor is that this currency isn't just distributed unequally. It's also something you can earn more of. You can build the capacity.
And the way you build it isn't by trying to be a better person in some abstract sense. It's by doing specific, boring daily practices that strengthen the underlying neural systems. 3 breaths. 5 minutes of loving kindness. Imagining someone else's context, none of it's dramatic, all of it adds up.
The quiet currency, built by quiet practices.
That's the whole thing. Empathy isn't a heroic virtue you either have or don't. It's more like, I keep coming back to archery, actually. You don't become a good archer by wanting to hit the target really badly. You become a good archer by practicing your stance and your draw and your release, over and over, until the thing that looked impossible becomes automatic.
And if you try to force it by wanting it more, you just get tense and miss.
The trying harder version of empathy is what burns people out. The practice version, regulate your own nervous system, build perspective taking, cultivate concern, that's sustainable.
So for someone listening who read Daniel's prompt and thought, yes, I want to be more considerate, I want to be more mindful of others. The first step isn't to focus harder on others, it's to check in with yourself. Am I overwhelmed? Am I drowning in my own stuff? Because if the answer is yes, that's where the work starts.
And that's not selfish. That's the foundation. You can't offer someone a steady hand if you're shaking.
The suffering paradox means that the people who seem most selfish may be the people most in need of exactly the kind of steady presence we're describing. And the tragedy is that their behavior makes it hardest to offer.
Which is why the training matters. If you can build the capacity to hold your own distress steady in the face of someone else's chaos, you become one of the few people who can actually reach them, not by fixing them, just by staying.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, the confound in the empathy measures. Personal distress masquerading as empathy. That seems like a problem that extends beyond research questionnaires.
It absolutely does. How many people do you know who describe themselves as too empathetic? Meaning, they get overwhelmed by others' emotions and then avoid difficult situations. That's not high empathy. That's high personal distress with low regulation capacity. Calling it empathy gives it a moral gloss it doesn't deserve.
It's almost the opposite of empathy, functionally. If empathy moves you toward someone, and personal distress moves you away, then calling personal distress empathy is getting the direction wrong.
And it lets people off the hook. I'm just too empathetic. Sounds like a virtue. I have poor emotional regulation, and it prevents me from being present for others. Sounds like something to work on.
Which brings us back to the training. The Trauman study found a 15% decrease in personal distress alongside the 22% increase in empathic concern. Those two numbers are related. As distress goes down, concern goes up.
They're inversely coupled. And that's the mechanism. When your brain isn't screaming threat, it has bandwidth for care.
Daniel's prompt asked about being more mindful and considerate. The mindfulness piece is literally the first step in the training protocol. It's not a separate thing.
Mindfulness is the foundation because it builds the capacity to observe your own experience without being hijacked by it. When someone else's suffering triggers your distress, mindfulness lets you notice, ah, I'm feeling overwhelmed right now, without immediately acting on the impulse to flee. That pause is where empathy becomes possible.
So the three practices: mindfulness for regulation, perspective taking for understanding, loving kindness for motivation. They're not three separate things you do. They're a sequence. You regulate first, then you understand, then you care.
And if you skip the regulation step, the other two collapse. You can't take someone's perspective if you're in full threat mode. Your brain won't let you. Perspective taking is a prefrontal function, and threat mode shunts resources away from the prefrontal cortex toward the amygdala and the stress response.
The neuroscience backs up the sequence.
It does. And it also explains why some people seem to get less empathetic under stress. They're not losing some fixed trait. Their brain is reallocating resources to survival, and empathy is a luxury the survival brain can't afford.
Unless you've trained the capacity deeply enough that it becomes automatic, like the archer whose form holds even under pressure.
That's the goal. Not to be empathetic in easy situations. Everyone's empathetic when things are calm. The goal is to maintain the capacity when things are hard, when someone's in pain and lashing out, when you're tired and overwhelmed yourself, when the person in front of you is making it really, really difficult to care.
And that's where the daily practices matter. 5 minutes of loving kindness on a calm Tuesday morning builds the neural pathway that you'll need on a chaotic Friday night when someone you love is falling apart.
The research on loving kindness meditation specifically shows that it increases activity in brain regions associated with positive affect and empathy, even in response to neutral stimuli. You're not just training yourself to care about people you already love. You're training your brain's default mode to include care as a baseline.
I want to touch on one more thing from Daniel's prompt. He said empathy hasn't been the subject of endless movies and literature the way love has. And I think he's right, but I also think that's changing. The entire true crime genre is basically an empathy exercise, trying to understand why someone did something unthinkable. The explosion of memoir and personal essay is empathy infrastructure. We're building it culturally, even if we're not naming it.
The research on perspective taking suggests that narrative, stories, books, films, is one of the most powerful empathy building tools we have. When you read a novel, you're literally practicing inhabiting someone else's consciousness. That's perspective taking training, and we do it for pleasure.
So the culture might be doing some of this work for us, even if we're not calling it empathy training.
It might be, but the targeted practices, the mindfulness, the loving kindness, the explicit perspective taking, those are more efficient. Reading novels builds empathy slowly over years. 8 weeks of structured training produces measurable changes.
Both and then. Read novels and do the breathing.
Read novels and do the breathing. That's not a bad prescription for a lot of things, honestly.
The open question I keep coming back to is about limits. We've established empathy is trainable. But what's the ceiling? Can you train yourself into compassion fatigue by overtraining? Is there a point where empathy becomes maladaptive?
The research suggests the training itself protects against compassion fatigue because it builds regulation alongside concern. Compassion fatigue isn't caused by too much caring. It's caused by caring without the capacity to regulate the distress that caring produces. If you build both capacities together, the ceiling is higher.
The danger isn't training empathy too much. It's training the caring without training the regulation.
That's the distinction between empathy training that works and empathy training that burns people out. The Trautmann protocol included mindfulness specifically to prevent that. You're not just amplifying the feeling, you're building the container.
The container metaphor is useful. If empathy is water, you need a vessel that can hold it without breaking. Personal distress is what happens when the vessel cracks.
The training strengthens the vessel. That's the whole thing.
I think Daniel's prompt landed at a moment when a lot of people are feeling like their vessels are cracked. The question of how to be more considerate. It's not abstract. People are exhausted and overwhelmed, and they know they're not showing up for each other the way they want to.
The answer isn't try harder. The answer is build the capacity. Start with 3 breaths. Start with 5 minutes. Start with imagining one alternative explanation for someone's behavior today. Small, concrete, daily. That's how the infrastructure gets built.
The quiet currency, earned in quiet ways.
That's the episode.
If empathy is trainable, the question that lingers for me is about the boundaries. We touched on this. Can you train yourself to empathize with someone who's harmed you? And if you can, should you? Is there a healthy limit where empathy becomes self-destructive? I don't think the research answers that yet, but it's the question I'm left with.
It's the right question. And it connects to something we'll probably need to tackle another time. As AI systems get more sophisticated, the question of machine empathy starts to loom. Can you train a model to do what we've been describing? But that's a whole other episode.
For now, the practical takeaway is clear. Empathy isn't a fixed trait. It's a set of trainable skills. And the first skill isn't caring harder. It's learning to hold your own ground.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for making this show possible.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you have a weird prompt you want us to tackle, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We read everyone.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.